Hey Central Ohio, the nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Nick Tyrone, who's the CEO of the Radix Think Tank and was formerly the executive director at Centre Forum, one of Britain's leading liberal think tanks. His novel, Popstar Jihadi, is the world's first novel to be published by a think tank and is an exploration of how, in a world where media is fragmented and debate so polarised, it becomes impossible to know what's real, even when the truth is revealed. Also with us is Eleanor Anstruther, who read History of Art at Manchester University before travelling the world. A Perfect Explanation tells a fictionalised account of a shocking true event in the 1920s where Eleanor's grandmother sold her son, Eleanor's father, to his aunt for £500. She came to uncover the incredible story in her aristocratic family's history with 10 years of research. And also with us is MP, or Mark Miles. He's a pilot, a diving instructor, and an award-winning chef. A lifelong sailor, he now lives in the Caribbean on board a yacht called Pacific Wave. Shelter Rock is a thriller about an African spy and a youth who retraces Mark's steps in a pulse-pounding pursuit through Africa. In 1981, Mark himself walked home alone as a teenager from South Africa to the UK, as you do. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Drench yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Nick Tyrone. He's the CEO of Radix Think Tank and was formerly the executive director at Centre Forum, one of Britain's leading liberal think tanks. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest novel. It's called Popstar Jihadi. It's the world's first novel to be published by a think tank. Welcome to the book show, Nick.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So tell us, first of all, can you, a bit about Radix and what you do there?
Yeah, certainly. So it is a think tank of the Radical Center. So the idea is really neither left nor right and trying to find a way through the difficult problems that we face at the moment.
And how long has it been going for? Why did you set it up?
It's been going for about 3 years. It was actually predated the Brexit vote, although one could see the problems that could be created by the vote, either way it went, even at that stage.
And how have things been progressing for you?
Well, it's interesting. It's a difficult terrain, I think mostly because whilst one could say that there is an appetite, I think, for something that isn't quite to the extremes of left and right that we're seeing, the truth is actually we have a political system, particularly the political scene in Britain right now is very polarized, you know, between left and right, between Leave, Remain. So it's difficult to I think at the moment it's difficult to plow a sort of center ground, but I think that is going to change shortly.
Yeah, it is a difficult time, isn't it, for sure?
Yeah, no, it is. Politics is a bit messy at the moment, so it's that makes life difficult, particularly if you're trying to advance policy, because there's just no space for it. Everything is about firefighting, everything's about Brexit. So to say, hey, here's some new great public policy, it's tricky to find the space for that, both in the public sphere and actually even within Parliament.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a bit about your book and the background behind it, can you?
Yeah, certainly. So it's called Popstar Jihadi. It is about it's a novel. It's about a world-famous pop star who walks on stage one night and blows himself up, kills himself and several of his fans. And what happens is I explore in the book the aftermath of that. So it's really an exploration of the sort of tragedy as seen through the lens of the 21st century sort of media landscape. So the blogosphere, the social media, and the mainstream media trying to sort of catch up and keep up with that. Both sort of trying to tell the truth as much as can be known and being very evidence-led, but by the same token obviously having to keep up with outlets who have a large following now, but don't have to have quite the same rigorous standards of journalistic integrity. So that's really what the book's about. I wrote it, I finished it actually in the summer of 2015, and was looking around for publishers for it. I went through several agents. Everybody, it sort of came out in the end that people felt that it was a bit too controversial. That was the feedback that I got. Mm. And so Radix was happy to publish it, you know, now.
Yeah, great stuff. And it's an interesting concept, isn't it? The whole idea of news and how, as you said, mainstream news outlets trying to catch up with the news being broken and talked about and discussed on social media. It's interesting how that's happened.
Yes. Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I think one of the things I had back in 2015 was people said, well, I know you're sort of looking at a kind of slightly dystopian near future, but truth is that this seems extreme, you know, the kind of stuff that I sort of documented, which seems very, I think all seems very realistic in 2019. You know, we've actually, in the ensuing 4 years, things have got much more extreme, I think, online, and I think much more polarized, and also much more confusing. I mean, for instance, this morning, it was very interesting that following in the wake of John Bercow's decision to not allow the third vote for Theresa May to go through, you actually, some of the responses from media were unintuitive. So you had the Sun, etc., saying, you know, being really harsh on him, but Leave.eu said it was great. Well, he should have done that. That was a perfect thing. So it's actually a very confusing media landscape more than anything.
Yeah, it's not just about reporting news anymore, is it? People have opinions.
Yeah.
Newspapers have sides and things.
Yes, and everybody's trying to figure out what their audience wants. So you're finding much more of it kind of being led by a supposed idea of what people want, as opposed to just saying, well, this is what we're going to say, and there'll be an audience for it. And so it's much more audience-led, which should be good, but then one has to wonder about the veracity of the audience in terms of its very existence. I mean, you can get into the whole thing about Twitter bots and things like that, and you know how much is we're having opinions being amplified beyond what they might actually possibly have in terms of real people following them.
Yeah. It's difficult to know, isn't it? What is news and what is opinion? You know, a lot of people, it's kind of become a bit of a joke. People kind of say things like, well, I read it online, so it must be true. Ha ha. You know, knowing that just because it's said on the internet or even printed in a newspaper, sadly, doesn't mean that it's true.
Well, I think one of the things as well is you've seen the rise of very professional looking sort of fringe outlets. So, you know, you see websites now that are that just look very professional and they look like real news. Or you see that with, you know, the Russia Today model where it looks like, it just looks like, you know, sort of BBC News, basically. And so people, that I think that's been a big thing that we've seen. It's not so easy to kind of spot the quote-unquote crackpots any longer. And in the book, I really explore that, you know, how actually you get things, very extreme opinions can have gone very mainstream in a way. So it's quite scary.
So can you tell us a bit more about your character of Noah, the guy who blows himself up, and why on earth he would do that?
Yes. Well, obviously, what forms most of the book is speculation as to why he did it, and everybody's sort of projecting onto him. And in a sense, he's kind of he's kind of a void. You know, he's a very troubled individual, and the reason that we find out as a reader as we go along doesn't really correspond at all to what everybody else is sort of projecting onto him. Whether that be people who want to project onto him, oh, this must have something to do with radical Islam, or well, this must have something to do with something else. And so by the end, actually, in a sense, no one's any the wiser. I mean, the reader is, because you get to the book is sort of every so often we get a sort of look into the last 24 hours of Noah's life leading up to the incident. And so we as the reader know, but actually the world at large, if you like, is none the wiser by the end. So which is sad in and of itself. I think, you know, again, we don't know what the truth is any longer.
Yeah. And where did the idea come from? Do you know?
Yes. Looking back on it, I remember just sort of thinking about different scenarios and how people would react, and then thinking about, well, what would happen if I'd been reading a lot of stuff in different news outlets, and I'd sort of wanted to do something around that, around sort of a satire around different forms of media. And then I was thinking of an inciting incident, and then one of the things that really triggered me was the thought process for it was, there was a thing going around in the right-wing media, certain far-right outlets, about how, you know, the Islamification of Europe and how we were going to be taken over. And then I started thinking about, well, if that was true, wouldn't we see more kind of people from non-Islamic backgrounds converting? Wouldn't that be a thing? And then I thought, well, what would happen if a sort of very, very, you know, the most sort of innocuous kind of pop star imaginable did something that provoked one, you know, basically incited a terrorist incident in, you know, off their own back. And what would be the, and then that got me thinking about the whole thing. You know, so really what it's about is about the someone who's so far outside of what someone would think of as being kind of capable of something like this, doing it. And then the loss of trust that you would get from people in the public sphere, and then how that would play out. And so that was really the genesis of the idea.
It's a frightening thought, isn't it?
It is. No, it's terrifying. And you know, I think in terms of the way we're seeing it, I mean, you know, it's very timely, actually, this phone call, because we're seeing it obviously this week in terms of and people's different reactions to things. And one of the things that you're seeing on Twitter is, well, why is the BBC overcovering the New Zealand incident, and it isn't giving the Dutch incident more? And you know, there's a kind of there's different narratives going on all the time, which actually have nothing to do with what actually happened at all. It's really just people, you know, spinning their own webs about things, which is depressing. I think it's a depressing aspect of the era we live in.
Yeah, and can cause all kinds of problems and heartache, as well as these terrorist incidents going on. There's also people, a guy who was in Love Island took his life this week, and that's the second person from the show to have taken their life. And there's all kind of talks about how people aren't given support after these shows, and people are sort of go from not being famous to being massively famous to then people just completely laying into them online and just not being able to cope with it all.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is a worrying aspect of the age we live in. I mean, I know I worry about it. I've got three kids. And actually, one of the things I really worry about all the time is my daughter had a, she managed to get a hold of a thing that was sort of, it was very odd. It sort of simulated a real audience, and she could do something, you know, and she's always saying to me, oh, I'd love to do something on YouTube. I want to do a thing on YouTube. And you think, oh, God, you know, I don't want to, she has no idea, you know, the kind of, particularly YouTube, you know, the sort of viciousness that exists out there for this sort of thing. And you know, you actually do feel for these people who sort of think, oh, I'll just be on this show and it'll be, you know, it'll be a laugh. And then actually to you can imagine, just you'd have to have a very thick skin to be able to handle it. And actually, a lot of people don't.
No.
And so, yeah,
and also the misconception that being famous is the be all and end all. If you've got, if you're famous, you get free stuff and everybody loves you and all that kind of thing. As if that makes you happy. But sadly, as we all see, it really isn't the case.
Yeah, well, in the book, I sort of explore that with Noah. This idea that there's nowhere for him to go. You know, he's reached the pinnacle. He's world famous. He's wealthy. He's achieved everything that he wanted to achieve. And it hasn't sort of done anything to quell his inner demons. And that sort of is part of what sort of provokes him to do what he does. You know, that's the thing. It's very sad in a sense. You get these guys who, you know, this is the thing they've always wanted, and it's going to make them happy, and they're going to get famous, and it's going to be, everything's going to be wonderful, and then actually they find it isn't wonderful, and in fact large portions of it are either tedious or downright awful. And what do they do? Where do they go? There's nowhere to go. I mean, I had a friend who was an actor years ago, and went through a lull in his career, and he sort of said, well, what can I do? You know, he was too famous to sort of quote unquote get a real job, as it were. He couldn't he was stuck just trying to and his career recovered eventually and he was sort of fine, but you got a sense of how scary that was, because there was, you know, he'd sort of trapped himself in that life and there was no way out.
Yeah. And when people do in that well, I don't know who you're talking about with your friend, but when people who have been in the public eye do get normal jobs, which does happen, again, people pick up on it in the press and get slated, oh, they're working in a restaurant now, you know, which is just awful.
Yeah, exactly.
Horrible.
Yeah. Well, it's just one of those things. And as you say, people don't really, I don't think before they go on, you know, Love Island or something, I don't think they're going to be thinking through all the ramifications of that.
No.
Yeah,
I wonder if people will start to a bit more now after the tragedy of these two people, or whether people, you know, will make a difference.
Yeah, on that. I mean, I think that a lot of these things are generational. When I think about the current terrain on social media, and as you say, people just sort of not really thinking about the ramifications of sort of short-term fame, I think a lot of that is going to be, I have hope for the next generation, because I think that if you think about the next generation who will have grown up with all this stuff, I think they're just going to be much wiser to some of it. I think they're going to be much more... they're going to be able to sort of sift through, you know, what's real and what isn't to a much greater degree than I think we do now.
Yeah.
That's my hope anyway. But yeah. I think that we will get there.
Absolutely. So your kids are going to be fine then. They're the next generation. They'll show us.
Exactly. I think they will be. That's my hope. I remain optimistic on that one.
Absolutely. Well, it's been great to chat with you. You've got some interesting subjects tackled in the book. It's called Pop Star Jihadi, and it's by Nick Tyrone, who we've been chatting to. Nick, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Eleanor Anstruther, who read History of Art at Manchester University before travelling the world. She's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel. It's called A Perfect Explanation. The novel tells a fictionalised account of a shocking true event in the 20s, where, dogged by depression, Eleanor's grandmother sold her son, Eleanor's father, to his aunt for £500. Welcome to the book show, Eleanor.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. And what an amazing story that you came across.
Thank you. I mean, it is. It was something, I think only now, having written it and talking about it such a lot, it's sort of coming home to me what an extraordinary story it is. I think I was so sort of used to it as a child. I didn't really occur to me, crazy as that sounds.
Yeah. So how and when did you hear about it then?
Well, it was something I always knew that you'd been. And as I say, it didn't occur to me that that was odd at all. And then I grew up and became a mother myself. And I think I just started thinking about who my grandmother was, because she never really occurred to me as a person at all. And so I started to ask, the first question I asked my father was, what was my grandmother called? What was his mother's name? And when I heard her name, she became real. And then, of course, it occurred to me, well, what on earth would drive you to sell your son? It just... Obviously, the more I looked into it, the more I thought, good Lord, you know. And so I began the research, and he was very very pleased to talk about it and to open up all the archives to me. So I went ahead.
So what did you find out then?
Well, I think what I found out really is that, you know, there's neither, people are neither good nor bad. There's a whole mixture of grey in between. And what I found out was that Enid, his mother, you know, she wasn't just a simply a terrible, bad, cruel person who didn't care. She was driven to that decision by a series of terrible events, some of them caused by her own decision, some of them caused by circumstance. For instance, I mean, the death of her brother at Gallipoli in the First World War was really the thing that kicked it all off. And then society's view that money should be in the hands of men. She didn't get on with her sister. There's lots and lots of sort of mitigating circumstances, really, that drove her to that. But I think probably the main one is that she did suffer from depression, certainly postnatal depression, and had no help.
Mm. And how did your father feel about all of this?
Well, he was a pretty closed shop in terms emotionally, in terms of talking about it. He was open about the facts, but he didn't really let his emotions sort of spill out around it at all, which I think was why I certainly felt that it hadn't really been a big deal. But of course, when I started talking to him about it, he opened up more, and although his language was still very sort of plain and unemotional around it, the feeling I had around it and him when he talked about it was anything but unemotional at all. And I think he felt, well, I don't want to put emotions into his name, but I think he felt incredibly hurt. And he wanted, when I asked him what would he say to his mother if she was here now, his response really surprised me. He said, read my books. He was a writer. And as a writer myself, I think what he was really saying was, look, I matter and I exist and notice me. And I think any child, no matter what their relationship with their mother, even if they have none at all, there's an instinctive need to be recognized by your kin and by the woman who bore you. And I think he felt ignored by her, which in a sense he was. He was fought over, but he wasn't really given any love from her.
And how do you think he would have felt about the book that you've written?
Well, I think there would have been a mixture of things. As a writer himself, he knew exactly how hard it is to write a book. He wrote nonfiction, and he used to say he didn't have the imagination for fiction. He thought it was a much harder thing to do. So he would have been incredibly proud, even though my book sort of drives a line between fact and fiction, because it's a fictional narrative around a factual tale. But on the other hand, he was a very private man and didn't really spill his, you know, I think in society now, which I think is a good thing, we happily talk about our emotions and our pain and all the rest of it. And he grew up in a societal land that just didn't allow for that. That wasn't the language of it. So he would have found it a bit odd, I think, probably. I think he would have found it odd that anyone was interested, really, in it. I think he would have been I feel that he's incredibly proud that it's out and he's free of it and we can all discuss it compassionately.
Yeah, lovely. So tell us about the characters in the book. Why did you sort of fictionalise it a bit?
Well, I mean, I started writing knowing nothing about writing at all, so I just wrote really blind as to what I was doing. I didn't really think about genre or the fact that normally one might use fictional names, for instance. So what I did was that I looked at my ancestors and I just thought, well, how did they go from A, B, C? How did they get from one fact to another? What was the emotional import behind all of that? And, of course, that I had to fictionalize. I fictionalized all the conversations, the rooms they were in, you know, the atmospheres and all the scenes. I imagined them, but only so that I could make sense of how they could have gone from one decision to another, because I knew the decisions they landed on. So I had to find a sort of narrative bridge, an emotional bridge between all of those, a fictional one. But on the other hand, I did try fictionalizing the names and make it sort of entirely a fictional novel, even though I would know it was true. And that didn't work at all. It seemed to me that every single one of them demanded to have their real name used. And I didn't really understand that that was its own genre, really, until I sent it out into the world and people said, okay, so it's real names, but written as a novel. And you don't really need to know that it's real. I think knowing it's a true story is the final impact of it. But that's just the way it came out, really. And they did, any writer will say, the characters dictate. And then the writer just has to wrestle them to the ground and try and make a story out of it.
And I understand you rewrote it a few times as you kept finding out more.
As I got better at writing, actually. I mean, the entire process of writing took a decade. I wrote at least 4 complete other versions, different titles, different perspectives, different tense, different genres almost. And every single one of them, they didn't work, but in hindsight, they were stepping stones to making it work. And I think the final thing for me really was that I sort of tore everything up in a fury. I just wasn't getting anywhere. And sat down and thought, well, I'm just going to write the book that I want to write, which is sort of how I'd begun, but 8 years previously to that, I didn't know how to write. But, you know, all of that under my belt, I then knew I did have the technical ability to do it. So I sat down and wrote it as a novella, actually. 27,000 words was the original size of the book that's now out there. And then I slowly expanded it from there and brought in the voices of Joan and Finetta to ride alongside Enid. And that worked. But you never know as a writer. You just have to keep plugging away at it and talking to it. And eventually it comes together like magic. It's amazing.
You must have learned an awful lot about the writing process through this book.
I learned a huge amount about it. As I say, I really didn't know how to write at all. I mean, I've got a natural gift for it. You know, I'm sort of, it's something I've done ever since as far back. I used to write books when I was little that didn't, I couldn't read them. They were just scribbles, but I was always writing, you know, so that is in me. But that's very different to the technical aspects of the craft. And I had some great teachers. Sally Klein at Goldust's mentoring scheme was absolutely brilliant. I went on the Arvin workshops, very, very good. The Guardian Masterclass workshops, they're very good. I had a great editor, freelance editor, Andrew Willey, who worked with the Writers' Workshop. So all these people along the line were very strict, you know, really taught me the craft of how to do it. And then you just have to keep going and going and going. I think every writer knows, you know, when you're indulging and when you're actually doing it as it should be done. And it's that firm line you have to walk along and be very, very determined.
And having,
and it's exhausting.
Yeah, oh, I bet. And having lots of different teachers, does everybody kind of teach the same? I mean, can you get conflicting information where you think, oh, that's not what the other person said? Does it get confusing?
Not for me. I know it can do, but I got lucky. I just had some very, very good teachers, and really all teachers pretty much say the same thing. And my father as well, you know, and he just used to say, look, turn up. And that's definitely one of the rules. If you don't turn up, nothing's going to get written. Sally Klein used to say, murder your darlings, which is absolutely chimes with anything anyone's ever told me. If you really love a sentence or a paragraph or a chapter and it's not working, but you love it, you have to get rid of it. So, because, you know, you're too invested in it on a personal level, it might make you look good. Do you know what I mean? So, and reading aloud, I mean, I've read every draft I wrote, I read aloud to myself at least 4 or 5 times the entire novel. And that's absolutely crucial because you can hear rhythms, you can hear mistakes, you can hear when you're indulging, when a sentence doesn't work. So all of my teachers pretty much said the same thing. And every time I go and listen to someone else talk about writing, Anna Byrne says the same thing. No grasping, follow the energy, sit with it. There's an enormous amount of patience you have to practice with writing and characters. Really sit with them and listen. I mean, one of the characters, Enid in the novel, she wouldn't talk to me for 7 years. The others, Joan and Pat, and they were rabbiting away, but Enid wouldn't turn around from the window. And it took 7 years for her to turn around and start talking to me, and I had to wait and wait and wait and wait and wait, and eventually she did. So, I mean, all those lessons I learned all run hand in hand.
Yeah. That's interesting. A bit about reading aloud makes a lot of sense.
It's crucial. I think, I mean, there are a few absolute crucial ones, and that's no question. I don't turn anything in now unless I've read it aloud at least twice.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. And so have you started another book? Has this set you on the path?
I have. No, there's a few things. They're all pretty under wraps. I can't tell you too much about them, but there's a couple of things. One a lot further ahead than the other. Set now, I can say that. And I'm fascinated by mental health. So I'm still sort of circling around that subject. Mm. It's quite a relief to be writing something in the present day. So I don't quite having to do such a lot of historical research.
Yeah.
And entirely fictional, which is fun.
Yeah.
Although, you know, having done it, there's such a fine line between fact, non-fiction and fiction. And my experience is that the characters in A Perfect Explanation, even though they were real people, they're just as real as the characters in the book that I'm working on now, you know, the experience of them. So, you know, that's where writers sort of enter a slightly different zone.
Yeah. And can you tell us a bit more about the title, A Perfect Explanation?
Well, yes, the line, it came from a bigger line. In chapter 3, there's a line where she says she hadn't spent 25 years building up a perfect explanation for her life, only to have it shot down in one surprise attack. And that was a line that just came out. And I was thinking, because I'd had so many other titles in my head, and that one just really came through. And then I shortened it. Actually, a friend suggested I should shorten it to just that. And it made sense because I'd given 7 or 8 years to each of the characters in the book, giving me their version of what they believed to be the truth of how they could have gone from, you know, being a family in mourning for their brother and son who killed at Gallipoli to selling, you know, the future heir. So they each needed to somehow explain to me how each one of them had got there. And I think with any of us, especially with something that's so steeped in shame, we sort of like to exonerate ourselves by giving our perfect explanation of how it happened. And I had to listen to all of that and then stand back and say, okay, well, this is my version. So it's as much mine as theirs. But what I've really tried hard to do is to, you know, neither exonerate nor accuse anybody, but just say, okay, this is what I think happened. And then every reader can make up their own mind about how they feel. And I know lots of the feedback and reaction I've had to it is that people have really enjoyed this sense that they sort of feel they should feel one thing, but they actually feel something completely different, or they change their view about characters as they go through. But I do believe it's the job of the writer to just tell the story and leave how the reader feels up to them. It's not for me to tell you how to feel about the people in my book. I just need to tell you what happened.
Well, I think that was a perfect explanation.
Well, thank you.
If listeners want to get a copy of the book, it's available to buy on our website in the bookshop section. It's called A Perfect Explanation, and it's by Eleanor Anstruther, who we've been chatting to. Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Mark Miles, or MP Miles. He's originally from a small town in Dorset. He's a pilot, a diving instructor, and an award-winning chef. A lifelong sailor, he now lives in the Caribbean on board a yacht called Pacific Wave. He's with us on the book show to talk about his novel. It's called Shelter Rock, and it's described as a heart-stopping espionage adventure. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Good morning. It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Tell us your view. Go on.
My view this morning, it's early morning. Dawn's just broken over the over St. Thomas. So I'm in the British Virgin Islands, which, for those who aren't aware, is the top of the Caribbean chain. And I'm sitting over flat blue water looking at some beautiful islands, and a few dolphins just swum past the boat, actually.
Oh, how wonderful.
Perfect timing.
Yeah. Did they wave at me?
Yeah, they waved, yeah.
Oh, it's lovely. It's a beautiful part of the world. I was there in St. Thomas, actually, various parts of the Caribbean, for my honeymoon about a year and a half ago, and it was absolutely stunning.
Well, if you come again, come and look us up, say hi.
Oh, that would be great. So tell us a bit about, I mentioned in the introduction, your background being a pilot, a diving instructor, award-winning chef. What kind of took you to write this book then?
Now, the book has been a long time in the making, in that it's based on true events that happened in the early 80s, and based on my own walk from Cape Town to Cairo back in that day. And it's taken a long time to gestate, and what really brought it about was some of the people that I meet on board the yacht that we charter in the Caribbean. And a lot of them are teenagers. A lot of them had listened to my stories of travels in Africa, and quite understandably were a little disbelieving. So I thought it important to try and write it down and show people today what the world was like only recently, but a world without Instagram and TripAdvisor and a mobile phone to call home with. And 4 years ago, I sat down and started writing, and it's been that long to get it together.
So just to clarify, you said you walked from Cape Town to Cairo.
Yeah, yeah.
That's quite a way for some milk.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it was completely unintentional. And of course, there were a lot of adventures along the way. I was arrested for spying in Uganda and robbed by thieving nuns in the Sudan, and
oh my goodness,
burnt down a brothel with some pygmies in Burundi, and lived basically for 7 or 8 months on the equivalent today of $200. So it wasn't luxurious travel by any means, and I came home with a few interesting tropical diseases, and yeah, that was the adventure.
And how old were you when you did this?
I was 18. I was on my own. I just finished school. I was supposed to be staying with a cousin, but outstayed my welcome in some respects. So, I never intended to. I thought I'd go as far as Johannesburg. I earned some money doing some acting in a TV commercial. So I thought I'd go and see Victoria Falls. And then I thought it was as far to go to Nairobi to catch my plane as it would be to go back to Cape Town. But when I got to Nairobi, they wouldn't let me on. So I was stuck and I had to keep going all the way. So that was it.
That's incredible. So how much walking were you doing each day?
Yeah, I could do like 30 kilometres a day. So I'd start really early and walk as hard as I could for about 4 hours, and then take a rest and do another couple of hours before lunchtime, and then rest most of the afternoon. And in the evenings, just amble along looking for somewhere to stay. And I stayed basically just by the side of the road, in the bush, on the beach, wherever it happened to be. It was a giant escape and evasion exercise through Africa that took 7 or 8 months.
What an amazing adventure. Do you look back at with fondness, or do you think, was I absolutely mad to do that?
Yeah, interestingly, I mean, now I think I was totally crazy to have done it. And people have asked me whether they'd do it today. And of course, I think it's a completely different world and I wouldn't advise it. But having said that, when I set off to do it in the 80s, I met an old guy who'd done it in the 40s after the end of the Second World War. And he said, well, I did it then, but I wouldn't do it today. So I don't know.
Yeah,
I'd like to do it again, actually. The aim is to I've got a couple more books to come out, and then the aim, given permission by my girlfriend, is to go back and repeat the trip age 60.
Oh, fabulous. It'll be interesting to see how the experience would be so much different today.
That would be the interesting part. Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
And also maybe how you'd handle it all differently.
Yeah, not so well. And a lot slower. Probably.
And maybe a few more beds thrown in as opposed to bushes.
Could be. Exactly. Yeah, that'd be luxury.
So tell us about the characters in Shelter Rock.
Shelter Rock is actually a spy thriller set in Africa in the 80s. And it features a Swazi spy who was the only black African working for the apartheid era South African intelligence service. And he's tasked reluctantly to follow a naive English boy through Africa because the boy has accidentally stumbled upon South Africa's biggest secret. So it's a chase through Africa from Cape Town to Cairo, obviously replicating my trip of the 80s, but with a true spy story behind it as well. And that's basically the book.
And tell us about some of the other people. You mentioned that the thieving nuns, which actually happened to you. I don't expect many people would put those two words in the same sentence. What actually happened?
Yeah, that they looked after me in return for money, which I wasn't really able to pay them. I was sick. I'd picked up hepatitis. So they had every reason to expect something. But sadly, I didn't have anything and I had a long way to go from Sudan. So while I was basically in a coma, they took everything they could out of my wallet.
Gosh.
And I'd like to meet them again and give them something more now that I'm able to, but
oh really, you'd give them something even though they stole from you?
At the time it left me in a bit of a hole, so,
yeah.
So there's a lot of characters that the boy who in the book is called Ralph meets along the way, and all of them are entirely true. You know, they're based on people that who I met and who helped me through the trip, and that's what I remember more really than the places. It's the people. And so there's a lot of interesting characters.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how that can happen when you're traveling, especially traveling on your own. You kind of look back on places, and so often it's the people that make the place. If you go somewhere and you don't really meet anybody interesting, then as far as I'm concerned anyway, with the traveling that I've done, I kind of go, yeah, it was okay. But then other places were amazing because of the people that I met.
Exactly right. Yeah. For an example, I was on Lake Tanganyika on a cement freighter. And the captain was a Zambian guy who'd been educated in Oxbridge somewhere. And he was intelligent enough to run Zambia, but chose to run a cement freighter on Lake Tanganyika. And he helped me a lot and educated me a lot on Africa in that at that time. So it was a really interesting character to meet and useful for all sorts of respects.
Yeah. And what about dangerous situations that you found yourself in? Were you ever feared for your life?
You know, I was 18. You know, you're invincible, aren't you? It can't be just me. You know, nothing could hurt you. I was arrested for spying and sat on the floor at a petrol station with, soldiers who only had made a living by forming roadblocks and taking money off people, and they sat me on the floor with guns pointed at my head, and even then I still couldn't believe that anything bad would happen to me. And they wanted money. I said I couldn't give them the money. It was all I had. I needed to get back to Shaftesbury. And,
where?
so that, you know, I was very naive, as, you know, 18-year-olds like to think they know everything about the world, but of course they don't. And maybe it was just that naivety and ignorance that got me through.
Yeah. I think it's great that you've written a book about it. Do you think at the time you thought you'd ever write a book about what your experience is?
not at the time. And I mean, I've done a lot of writing since, nothing like this, mostly sort of for sailing magazines and book reviews and yacht test reports. And afterwards and since, when people have heard about the trip, they suggested I should write it down. And it's taken a long time to actually to weave it into a story, as well as it just being a sort of travel log. So I'm glad it's done.
Yeah. And do you think there's another book in you about sailing, perhaps?
Yeah, actually, I'm halfway through the next one, which is set in Portugal at the time of the Carnation Revolution in 76. Because I ended up shepherding in Portugal as well as everything else. So drawing on my Portuguese experience, where I lived there for 7 years, and became intrigued with the recent history, political history of Portugal of that period. So it's more of a thrilling love story set in Portugal in the 70s. And of course, the third book has got to be about the Caribbean and a chase probably from one end of the Caribbean chain to the other. And the fourth book I referred to is going to be me recreating the 1980s African adventure from Cape Town to Cairo.
Great,
so, yeah,
stuff.
Looking forward to all of those.
You got a bit of a plan then?
Yeah, I've never had a plan before in my life, but that appears I've got one for 5 years at least.
So how are you able to find the time to write? Are you busy with the yachts and everything? Are you cooking, and what's your kind of daily life like?
Yeah, sadly, no, we're not very busy at all.
So, oh, fine, yeah,
maybe. I think actually last week I worked about 4 weeks. Last year I worked about 4 weeks of the year. So,
oh, how lovely.
Yeah. So, we take guests for a week's charter around the Virgin Islands, mostly Americans because it's easy for them to get to. A few Brits, but when we're on charter, obviously, it's 24/7 for a week. And when we're not, I've got nothing much to do. I work on the boat in the morning, cleaning or fixing something. And every afternoon I write. And that's been my routine for pretty much the last 10 years.
Fantastic. And might be a silly question for other people listening, thinking it sounds like a dream, but I want an honest answer from you. Do you ever get bored, or do you feel like you're in heaven?
I don't get bored because, you know, we can just move the boat, and that's the nice thing about it. We can find a new bay, a different beach, and I don't tire of the predictably perfect weather that I wake up to every morning. I throw on some trunks every day, and if I get bored, I just go snorkeling and look at fish.
Yeah. Fabulous. Good answer. I think if you said you got bored, people might throw things at the radio.
Yeah, I'm very lucky.
Yeah.
Very lucky. I appreciate it.
Fabulous. Well, it's been great to chat with you. Thanks so much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of Shelter Rock, it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by MP Miles, who we've been chatting to today. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
Hey, Central Ohio. The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.